Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks. Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everybody. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights. Every Sunday, we invite you to participate in our weekly conference calls. The number to dial is area code 712-432-1500, and the access code is 220-981-POUND. Those calls happen every Sunday evening at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So we invite you to participate, call in, let us know what's going on in your city, and how possibly the UAC and or Sign of the Times can help support what you are doing there. We also would like to ask that you please make your $10 monthly donation via our PayPal account at signothetimes19@gmail.com. Again, our PayPal email address for your generous $10 monthly donation. We appreciate it very, very much. And for those who have already contributed, we appreciate you as well. The number to dial in tonight, 917-889-8059. If you'd like to participate in the listening session, you also can participate via the web, via our link on www.tobtr.com/s. And there are several numbers here, 732-82217. So you've got two ways that you can listen to the Sign of the Times, and we invite you to take advantage of both of those means. Tonight, we're going to have a listening session. I want to first shout out to the group RBG, the Ones Who Fight, who I generously borrowed this clip from that we're going to listen to tonight. It's going to last about a little over an hour, and then we'll see where things are as far as participation at that point. We are a little behind schedule getting started tonight. This is due to some technical difficulties, but we're here. All praises to the Most High for giving me common sense and a lot of perseverance. So I hope you all enjoy listening to the Black Power mixtape, 1967 to 1975. There are several freedom fighters who are featured in this mixtape, so I invite you to please look it up, please Google it, and if you get a chance to check out it in its entirety, it's about a little over two hours long. So this is 1 hour of the Revolutionary Mixtape, 1967 to 1975. Enjoy, y'all. This is Queen Tide here. I'll be back. Peace.
Now, let us begin with the modern period of, I guess we could start with 1956 for our generation. This was the beginning of the rise of Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King decided that in Montgomery, Alabama, black people had to pay the same prices on the buses as did white people, but we had to sit in the back. And we could only sit in the back if every available seat was taken by a white person. If a white person was standing, a black person could not sit. So Dr. King and his associates got together and said, "This is inhuman. We will boycott your bus system." Now understand what a boycott is. A boycott is a passive act. It is the most passive political act that anyone can commit. A boycott. Because what the boycott was doing was simply saying, "We will not ride your buses." No sort of antagonism. He was not even verbally violent. He was peaceful. Dr. King's policy was that nonviolence would achieve the gains for black people in the United States. His major assumption was that if you are nonviolent, if you suffer, your opponent will see your suffering and will be moved to change his heart. That's very good. He only made one fallacious assumption. In order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none.
Okay. First thing that crossed my mind with Stokely is, you know, he has so much power and passion and fire inside of him, and he understood what his job was very early, and he understood why, even though the things he was saying were in direct opposition to the philosophy of Dr. King, he understood that Dr. King was still important. He understood the compassion. What struck me, though, is interesting that from his vantage point, nonviolence and passive resistance was a non-option. It wasn't an option at all. Now, in 2010, you can see how, you know, King and all of them who were influenced by Gandhi, how it did work, you know? The passive resistance of the bus boycott, it did work. But it would have never worked without people like Stokely Carmichael on the other side of it. They studied the passive resistance. He studied power and what power meant. He was the first one to really talk about black power. But, I mean, that's exactly what was missing from the equation, the power. And he was powerful just from the speaking. And he wasn't even like the Panthers. You know, the Panthers were very influenced by him. But he, it's not like he was in the street with some guns, you know.
A few words about Martin Luther King's nonviolence movement.
I think Dr. King is a great man, full of compassion. He is full of mercy, and he's very patient. He is a man who could accept the uncivilized behavior of white Americans, their unceasing taunts, and still have in his heart forgiveness. Unfortunately, I am from a younger generation. I am not as patient as Dr. King, nor am I as merciful as Dr. King. And their unwillingness to deal with someone like Dr. King just means they have to deal with this young generation.
And we look at this program as a very international type program. It's for any human beings who want to survive. So
it's a plain socialist program, you mean?
Definitely. Socialism is the order of the day and not Nixon's black capitalism. That's out.
Black Panthers is an armed organization. What does that mean?
It means that if any racist dog, policemen, or pigs come up and attack us at any point or whatever point, we will defend ourselves, we will shoot them, we will kill them because we are bent on surviving.
And you have arms to do this?
Oh, definitely. And we're trying to get as many arms as we can, and we're teaching the people themselves in the community to arm themselves.
I wanted some grassroots up power to the people, legislation and laws that gave the grassroots real empowerment, you know what I mean? What I believed in was how we could get greater community control and community input into the political institutions that affect our lives. The very philosophy and slogan that we're spouting is all power to all the people. Whether you're white, black, blue, red, green, yellow, or polka dot, in the final analysis, we want real people's community control empowerment.
There's no hope in dope. Although you always remember that, especially with the school children out of school for the summer, and it's summer in the city.
I used to steal from my mother. I used to do things I really didn't want to do. I had family problems. My stepfather asked me out. That's something I'm holding, and I could never come up and tell my mother, you know, that her husband asked me to go out. You know, that's something I had to hold in. The easiest thing I knew how to do was to prostitute, man. I used to go up in Prospect Avenue and hang out on the corners up there till somebody come along and whistle or drive their car by, right? They used to call me up. I used to get in there. I used to say, you want a blowjob, you know, something. They take me to the hotel. And I'd get down with them. I didn't want to do it, but it's something that I had to do. I got down with them for about $5-6. Then I find that wasn't enough. Had to do it constantly. About 10 men just to get $30. And I couldn't care who it was, you know. It didn't make me no difference who it was, where he came from, as long as he had a couple of dollars to give me. My little sister, they wouldn't respect me, you know. They would be embarrassed to walk down the street with me and shit. I had no self-confidence in myself. Until my brother had came into a program, right? And I was still, I wasn't ready to come in. Because I was, you know, I thought dope was in, you know. Kept shooting dope. I liked it. Because it feels like when I was high off heroin, I could talk to people, you know. I could party along with people. I don't have to stay in the house, watch TV, go to bed, get up. I hanged out all night, wouldn't go to sleep. At the time, I liked what I was doing. I didn't know why. Until I got hooked on it, then I had to get it. I was doing things I didn't want to do. Now I'm just trying to make it now. I think I can make it.
The night that Dr. King was on, we spoke about death. I asked him the question, did he fear for his life? And he said, not really. He'd overcome his fear of death, and now he was focused on not how long he would live, but what would be the quality of the time that he would live. When he said, this is no longer about race, it's now about the welfare and the well-being of human life. We must talk about economics. We must talk about where people are poor. We must galvanize our nation to begin to take care of the poor. America should not have no poor people. No one should ever go to bed hungry. There should be gainful employment. There should be a living wage. There should be access to health with no charge. We should have education for free, like so many other nations successfully have applied. All these things put a huge bullseye on Dr. King because he was now tampering with the playground of the wealthy. And when he came to that moment about dismantling the economic construct, he had to go.
In a thunderous, resounding, united voice, that we have no intention of stopping this fight until we have eradicated every single remnant of racism in this country. Until we have ended the war in Vietnam and the neo-colonialism in Africa. We are not going to stop fighting until every political prisoner is free and until all the monstrous dungeons in this country are mere memories of a nightmare. Sisters and brothers, that is what the power of the people is all about.
You're standing in a place where the largest collection of black books in the world. And I started off some 40 years ago in this place, sleeping in a cellar. My receipts each day was around $1.25. But I don't tell how much my receipts is today for Internal Revenue will be looking for me.
Everything about who I am comes from growing up in Brooklyn and comes from my parents. They laid the foundation. But a big part of why I've been able to touch the world through my music and express myself has to do with the years I spent in a black bookstore. I mean, this store looks, in Harlem, identical to Nkiru Books that I worked at. The book titles, I know all those books. I read all those books. And it's interesting that that stuff was still relevant to me when I was working there in the 90s, as relevant as it was in the 70s, because the issues are still the same.
Malcolm X was the smartest uneducated. You see, Malcolm X, they could find nobody with no degree of PhD could debate him on truth. And naturally, this country can't stand truth. Now, I was lecturing the other day down in this same cellar, and a gang of little black boys came in. They held up their fists talking about black power. I said, look, son, I'd like to straighten you out. I said, black is beautiful, but black isn't power. Knowledge is power. For you can be black as a crow, you can be white as snow, and if you don't know and ain't got no dough, you can't go, and that's for sure. The white man that landed here, he came with two great weapons. One is the Bible, and the other was the gun. If it didn't humble you with the Bible, it crumbled you with the gun. And he's still praising the Lord and passing the ammunition all over the world.
You know, the points he said about black power, I think, is very, very, very important. But you have to grow and change. You can't just be caught up in the racial aspect of it. You have to, he said in the little poem he said you have to know and you have to have the dough. You know, you can't just be caught up in, oh, do it just because it's black. So it's interesting that he ran a black bookstore. He understood the importance of the bookstore, but he also understood it's not just about the black. You know, it's, that's a tool. That's not the goal.
My treatment was generally abusive and oppressive, and primarily because of the fact that I was a prisoner of war and a political prisoner.
What do you think is going to happen with the Black Panthers now? You're losing your leaders, etc.
It is true that many of our leaders have been confined in the concentration camps here in America. I know that the Black Panther Party will prevail. It is the vanguard of the people's struggle, and that while leaders are put into prison, new leaders are born, new leaders are made.
The birth of this nation was conceived in the genocide of the red man. Genocide of the red man. Of the red man.
I was in San Francisco helping to begin Black Studies when Stokely came with his cadre to merge with the Black Panther. And I remember the gorgeous signs that they made. I remember the meeting. And what we began to see at that point was the fusion of the Southern movement with the Northern movement to form quite a group of young people who were looking at the world in a way that did not necessarily say nonviolence, but it didn't say violence. It merely said at some point, let's take the movement a step further.
I believe that a time has come, a point has been reached, where a line just has to be drawn. There's a favorite line that I know about, and it says that there is a point where caution ends and cowardice begins. All three of these pigs that we have a choice of, Oink Nixon, Oink Humphrey, and Oink Wallace, they're not for us. They do not represent the best interests of this country. They definitely don't represent the best thinking in this country. In fact, they represent the very worst tradition which was ever to crawl from beneath the rocks in this bankrupt country.
And in my case, when I think about the fact that Ronald Reagan was the governor of California, Richard Nixon was the president of the U.S., the whole apparatus of the state was set up against me. They had all of their resources, and the FBI, the police, and they really meant to send me to the death chamber in order to make a point. It really didn't matter who I was, or it was that I was a very convenient figure to make a point that they would suppress any efforts at revolution and liberation.
A year ago, the Black Panthers were much more active. You heard much more about that type of struggle. Is the time of the Black Panthers past?
The Black Panthers still exist, and the Black Panthers are still extremely active in the Oakland community and in communities all over the country. I'm not sure whether you are aware of what is now happening in the Black Panther Party and the kinds of things that members of that party are doing
now.
No,
but tell me.
First of all, if you're going to talk about a revolutionary situation, you have to have people who are physically able to wage revolution, who are physically able to organize and physically able to do all that is done.
Yeah, but the question is more, how do you get there? Do you get there by confrontation, violence?
Oh, is that the question you were asking?
Yeah.
See, that's another thing. When you talk about a revolution, most people think violence, without realizing that the real content of any kind of revolutionary thrust lies in the principles and the goals that you're striving for, not in the way you reach them. On the other hand, because of the way this society is organized, because of the violence that exists on the surface everywhere, you have to expect that there are going to be such explosions. You have to expect things like that as reactions. If you are a black person and live in the black community all your life and walk out on the street every day seeing white policemen surrounding you, when I was living in Los Angeles, for instance, long before the situation in L.A. ever occurred, I was constantly stopped. No, the police didn't know who I was, but I was a black woman, and I had a natural, and they, I suppose, thought that I might be a, quote, militant. And when you live under a situation like that constantly, and then you ask me, you know, whether I approve of violence, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all. Whether I approve of guns. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. Some very, very good friends of mine were killed by bombs that were planted by racists. I remember from the time I was very small, I remember the sounds of bombs exploding across the street, our house shaking. I remember my father having to have guns at his disposal at all times because of the fact that at any moment, we might expect to be attacked. The man who was at that time in complete control of the city government, his name was Bull Connor, would often get on the radio and make statements like, niggers have moved into a white neighborhood, we better expect some bloodshed tonight. And sure enough, there would be bloodshed. After the four young girls who lived, one of them lived next door to me, I was very good friends with the sister of another one. My sister was very good friends with all three of them. My mother taught one of them in her class. My mother, in fact, when the bombing occurred, one of the mothers of one of the young girls called my mother and said, can you take me down to the church to pick up Carol? We heard about the bombing, and I don't have my car. And they went down, and what did they find? They found limbs and heads strewn all over the place. And then after that, in my neighborhood, all of the men organized themselves into an armed patrol. They had to take their guns and patrol our community every night because they did not want that to happen again. I mean, that's why when someone asked me about violence, I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
You know how many guys out here like me selling dope? You know how many kilos of dope come to the United States? You know how many times it's handled and how many people get a cut off that money? Everyone is selling dope. From the government on down. You don't cut off the hand that feeds you. So in other words, if that's where I'm getting the dope from, should I tell and cut off my neck?
I mean, yeah, you know, the 60s was very revolutionary in terms of thought and in terms of imagery. Black is beautiful. We love ourselves. And it's documented. It's not even a myth or anything that is a conspiracy theory that the community was flooded with drugs in order to stop this stuff. I mean, you know, Hoover and the FBI, and they made sure that the drugs were an influence in the community. And it certainly had its effects. Just how drugs affect your brain, they affected the community. It made everything out of focus. hurting Fuzzy. The drugs almost had a renaissance when they did the same thing with crack. You know, it was heroin then, it was crack after that. But that's, you know, people who are poor and oppressed, they focus on survival. The drugs seem like an easy escape route.
I'm 27 years old, and I can remember back 1966 when I first went to the United States Army. Now they have brothers overseas that don't even know about heroin. And they come overseas with the fact of being a good soldier, you know, doing for their country what they have no country, you know. And they goes over there and they get hooked. You know, I think they wanted it this way, you know, because so many brothers done died, it's a shame, you know. And they be lying about the fact, they be lying, they be saying your son died in combat. He didn't die in combat, he died from an overdose. And as you can see in the papers, everybody's involved. Big people's involved. They can't break it open.
We were aware of some of the collateral consequences of the war in Vietnam, including the fact that young men who fought there returned with serious drug problems. And that was the beginning of the period where massive drug problems in black communities, and the government was involved in some way, the CIA was involved with the distribution of drugs. Drugs were responsible for the receding of militancy and, you know, revolutionary impulses in black communities all over the country.
I'm frustrated all the time by what I see and wonder when it'll end and if it ever will end. I'm frustrated by Whitey's contributions. His contributions are usually drugs, which bring to me youngsters of my race, young people. This is why it's so frustrating. These are pre-teenagers, 13 to 15, from overdose. And we see this too often.
To call this a war on drugs, it evokes a very, very violent image. So you have, by the mere name alone, you think of what comes with war, the violence, the casualties, the explosions, the pain, the grief, the suffering, the messiness of it all. If you are on the other side of the war, you are an enemy combatant, and enemy combatants can be dealt with however. And indeed, the war on drugs swept everyone up, and the numbers speak for themselves. As the black population comprises 13% of American citizens, yet 49%, almost 50% of the prison population, it begs the question, who is failing whom?
I think the Black Power movement, see, I always think of it as three different movements, three different legacies. The most evident is this idea of building black institutions, buying black, supporting black business, but not necessarily transforming or revolutionizing society. Nowadays, it's manifest in slogans like the color of black power is green. It's about making money and supporting our businesses. It's not a revolutionary ideology. Another extreme, and that is a kind of cultural nationalism, and it goes in ebbs and flows. When Spike Lee's film Malcolm X came out, it was the height of a kind of cultural nationalist sort of resurrection. And then finally, the other element is the black radical tradition. It's a tradition of struggle, of organization. And how does it exist today? It certainly exists in certain forms of hip-hop. You know, you can actually chart both the organizational forms and rhetoric of black power in second wave feminism, in the gay liberation movement, where the gay liberation movement post-Stonewall in New York, but also in San Francisco, in many ways adopted the language of black power, gay power, feminist power,
sometimes I feel like there's a lot of rebuilding in order, and a lot of that is going to come from just the old-fashioned principle of reading books. And more importantly, we have to write and document our history right now. It's really not about black and white. It's about the story. If we're going to tell the story, let's tell the story right. So that's why we as black people have to tell our own stories. We have to document our history. When we allow someone else to document our history, the history becomes twisted and we get written out. We get our noses blown off.
Because of the historical aspects of people of African descent here in the United States of America, it's been a tremendous ride here since slavery and since Ku Klux Klan and all this madness in this country, you see. And so the black man in America has been able to survive all of this and be able to express himself through music and through art and through all kinds of things, and been able to utilize the government here and the rules and regulations, the Constitution and Declaration of Independence, and utilize this in a nonviolent way to be a part of one of the greatest countries that's ever been, the United States of America.
It's not a day that I don't get up and thank a Stokely and a Malcolm and a Kathleen and an Angela who did this very hard work for us to begin to not only see the country, but to see ourselves and to love ourselves. When you love yourself, you don't want to hurt someone else. And the other thing is that when you love yourself, you greet people as an equal.
I think the story of my trial is an important story. You know, we can talk about others, Bobby Seale and Erica Huggins and Huey Newton and go on and on. And the real import of the positive outcomes of these trials is that they demonstrated that people can collectively generate the kind of power that can be earth-shaking, that can change lives, that can change societies. And people need to know that, particularly in the 21st century, it is important, even under a black president, to bring the kind of pressure to force the kinds of issues that will allow us to imagine a future without war and without racism and without prisons.
If you look at the world, my dear brother, you can wake up, you can say, I don't want to get up out of bed, because, I mean, the rich are getting richer, not only in America, but in the world. The young people have got to see it. I mean, sometimes a lot of the young people who are in their 40s now say, I'm tired. I say, you can't be tired. Take a rest. Take a vacation. But this is a lifetime job. We've got to talk about that 1% or 5% that runs everything, you know. It's a lot of work. You don't get any reward. I say, you really don't get a reward. But the point is that the reward is knowing that when you make transition, when you die, if you have children, there's a better world for them. And if you don't have children, there's a better world for other people too.
Well, I don't think that I have any very critical medical problems, but I do have some things that should be taken care of.
And they can't take care of it in prison?
Well, we're working on that now. One of the problems in Marin County was that they insisted that the security arrangements had to be such that I could never be removed from the building itself, so that when, for example, I had dental problems, the dentist would have to search all over the Bay Area for portable equipment. They'd bring in a barber's chair and lean my head against some kind of a counter and try to fix my teeth that way. And in general, a lot of the problems stem directly from the fact that I just haven't been able to get the kind of medical treatment that I would get if I weren't in jail.
How do you spend your days?
Here? I've only been here for a couple of weeks, you realize.
Yeah, but in jail in general?
Well, the situation is somewhat different here than it was in Marin County. In Marin County, unless I had a court appearance. I was inside all the time. I had two cells, one of which was for sleeping and one of which was for working. I couldn't work in my sleeping cell, and I couldn't sleep in my working cell. I wasn't allowed to visit with the other women very much. Only on very rare occasions did I get to go over to the other side, and even then there was always a matron on duty sitting outside of the bars. They gave as their reason for that kind of arrangement the fact that they thought that someone might attempt to harm me in the jail.
Are you free to read and write what you want, you know?
Yeah. That's about all I do, in fact.
Because since all this time you've been in prison, we have had uprisings in other prisons, and they have a lot of demands, and one of them was that they were not allowed to read what they wanted, and the mail was censored, and they were treated in many bad ways. Do you understand them?
Well, before I was arrested, I devoted a great deal of my own time to the struggle, the emerging struggle around the prisons. I was led to that, actually, by my involvement in the Soledad Brothers Defense Committee. I began as a coordinator of a committee which concerned itself primarily with defending George Jackson and Fleeta Drumgo and John Cluche against the charges, which we felt were instances of political retaliation. In the process of doing research into what was actually going on around the Soledad Brothers case, we began to realize that it just wasn't a question of having to defend political prisoners who were already in prison, but that something was terribly wrong with the prison system, and that this, in fact, had to be a central struggle for not only for revolutionaries and not only for radicals, but for all people who really believe that justice ought to prevail in this country. There were so many things that I had absolutely no idea of that were going on in prison. So I think it sort of generally tends to be the case in almost any society that the whole realm of jails and prisons is something that people don't want to look at and don't want to be bothered with. It's a kind of a nightmare which they tuck away somewhere and don't want to open themselves up to. After we discovered that it was not only George Jackson and Fleeta Drumgo and John Cluche, but thousands and thousands of brothers and sisters all over the country who were receiving the same kind of treatment, who were being subjected to the same kind of political reprisals, and then just basic human rights were being violated. There was a case in Soledad, for instance, involving something they called the strip cell. And apparently, without any kind of a hearing, not just a court hearing, but without any kind of administrative hearing behind the walls of the prison, men could be placed in this box-like cell with nothing. I think there was a cement floor, a hole in the floor to use as a toilet, and no light. And that was it. They could be placed in this cell for up to 30 days. And the descriptions of this particular strip cell, which can be found actually in the transcript of a court case because the strip cell was eventually abolished, the descriptions of the things that went on in Soledad around it are just absolutely unbelievable.
Is violent uprising, like in Attica and other places, is that justified to change situations like that?
Well, I think that what happened at Attica was that many people in this country and all over the world who had not yet become aware of what the situation in the prisons across this country actually is had their eyes open.
And the effect might be change.
I think that some degree of change is occurring and has already occurred. It's interesting that not very long ago, an ex-Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, said that he was beginning to believe more and more that what had to occur in this country was that prisons had to be abolished. Prisons as we see them now, prisons with their present structure and their present functions in the society.
And some other type of correction instead.
Yeah, precisely. But of course, when you talk about corrections, and especially as that relates to black people and Chicanos and Puerto Ricans and poor people in general, it's very difficult to talk about rehabilitation in any kind of authentic sense, because the real problem is not the fact that a man or woman has gone out and has stolen some object here and there. The real problem is that of creating a society where men and women are not forced to resort to those kinds of methods in order to survive. So that there's a contradiction at the very heart of the whole notion of rehabilitation in the prison.
Is it the worst handicap to be a woman? Is it worse than being black?
I find in the field of politics, and I say politics specifically, in the field of politics, I have met far more discrimination as a woman than being a black person in politics.
What kind of reaction did you find when you said that you were going to run for the presidency? Both a black and both a woman from the male white establishment? Did you think you were crazy? Or?
Oh, well, the male establishment just thought it was just one great big joke. Of course, I don't think many of them were terribly surprised at this particular action because of the fact that they have always understood that Shirley Chisholm was somewhat of a maverick, very independent-minded. So I guess many of them felt, oh, there she goes again. And they didn't believe that I was really serious. And I think most people, not only men, but I think most people didn't really believe I was serious because of the fact that it takes millions of dollars to run for this office in this country.
Oh, you have no money, really.
Oh, I have a relatively small amount of money, but I have something that many of the other candidates don't have, as you can see here. I have foot soldiers. I have people.
And that is just as good as a lot of commercials on TV and so forth.
Right, but the important thing is to be able to mobilize the people, to coordinate them to do the job that has to be done. But I have the most important resources in this game, and that's the people, to be able to get them to work.
You have a new audience in here. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
White man ain't going to let her be the president. Never. If she will become a president, she won't last. To kill Martin Luther King, just kill the president, the labor union here, a small local union, president international of the labor union. He just got killed Sunday, and he wasn't nothing but a labor union. So what you think about the president of the United States being black?
What do you think about her? She's trying anyhow.
I think a lot of her. I hope she can succeed. I'm going to vote for her, but that still don't make her make it.
Well, the white man don't want us too far in his world. He wants us to just give us a little bit just to keep us from throwing bricks and balls and tell us he's going to fix the streets and everything. He might do that. So far as being a black president, never. Never.
How much? A vice president, huh?
Huh?
A vice president, is that possible?
Nah, not possible.
Nothing
never.
With power,
nothing,
really?
Nothing with power, never. Because they know if the black man ever get in the seat, president, vice president, a lot of things are going to change.
Well, I'm pushing that we will have a black president this coming term. And the next term, next 4 years, I'm wishing that we have a next. I'm going to vote for everyone. Every one of them. I'm pushing forward for that. I want to see today. If I don't see it, I want some of my kids and grandkids to see it.
What do you say about that? Is that unrealistically optimistic?
Well, I can't say. What I believe is going to happen in maybe the next 7 years would be a revolution, a black revolution.
But that if we understand the nature of power in our land, we will be able to put together a coalition of all of those forces in this country that have never had the opportunity to say anything, absolutely anything, about who is going to guide the ship of state for 4 years, namely the presidency of the United States of America. We need a new voice on the American scene. a voice whose first commitment is to the American people, the poor, the downtrodden, the Indians, the black, the poor white, the youth, and the women. We need a person who will not be espoused by powerful interest groups in this country, because those groups who put voluminous sums of money into the respective campaigns expect to get something out of the person who becomes the president, and then you are at the very bottom once again on the list of priorities.
We are not rolling out the red carpet for you, but to prove our love for you, we are presenting to you these flowers.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to introduce Mr. Fred Soto, our city commissioner.
On behalf of the city of Sarasota, we welcome you here. We got something you can wear and be. Remember our beautiful city here, Ms. Chisholm.
Yeah, sorry,
you want to take a picture of it?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Okay.
Of course, those persons who have been the beneficiaries of the status quo in this nation, they don't want to give it up to anybody else. They don't want to open the doors, even though they talk about the bulwark of democracy, the multifacetedness of America. They don't want to talk about maybe an Indian running, maybe a Chicano running, maybe a black running, maybe a woman running. The only thing that matters is that white males must make the determination of everything in this country.
If you were elected, would you be surprised?
But
sometimes when one listens to you, one gets a feeling that the most important is that somebody dare to run.
Of course, it's very important that someone dares to run to let everybody else in America know that the presidency of this country is not the exclusive domain of just white males. There are other kinds of people that make up America that need to be have some input on the highest level. And of course, if you're going to break that tradition, you've got to have courage and you've got to have guts. And so therefore, because I've always had courage and I've always had guts, I dare to run. It's as simple as that.
Would you be surprised if you were elected?
Oh, I don't know if I'd be surprised. I'd say the time is long overdue in terms of blacks' contribution to this country.
Let's imagine you are elected and your first day in office. What is the most urgent political action you would take? What was the first thing you would do?
The first thing, I would change the White House from being called the White House and call it the Polka Dot House. Secondly, my cabinet, my department heads, my agency heads will be reflective of all of the different kinds of peoples that make up America. You won't only have white males dominating the departments and the heads of agencies. You'd have women, you'd have blacks, you'd have Indians, you'd have Spanish. You'd have truly the American dream reflected. That would be the very first thing I would do, because it is my contention that in terms of this coalition candidacy, that we need many more kinds of Americans in positions of policy and administrative decisions in this country.
I think she is the only candidate that offers anything to me. She said more that I can relate to than any other candidate I've heard so far. I haven't heard them in person, but I've heard them on Meet the Press, and I've heard them, I mean, read what they said in the newspaper. And I like what she says, and I think she's got guts.
Well,
okay?
What did you say?
Well, I like her because, you know, her ideal of equality in the world, you know, and, you know, a way of, you know, reversing things, you know.
Think she's going to make it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, she keep up the good work.
I think she has very much a chance of being president if she can get the nomination. This business of the primaries and the delegates is something else again. But I think she's offering all of America, including white men, something that they haven't had a chance at for a long time, which is an honest candidate.
Which means you're going to vote for her?
I certainly would.
I think she has a definite program for change, and I think she would just bring about a welcome change in this country because she has so much to offer to us.
Yeah. Chair, over here, can I, before you go, can I just ask you, what would you like the idea of a black female president?
I don't have anything against the idea.
Would you like, you listen to Shirley Chisholm, I guess?
Yes.
What do you like, what do you think about it?
I think she has a lot of power and a lot of very good ideas.
Would you vote for her?
I may.
You may?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very good idea for a woman to run for president, but I wouldn't vote for a woman just because she was a woman. Several of the things that Ms. Chisholm said, I thought were good comments, but she didn't tell us exactly how she was going to solve these problems.
And what she wants is to have something to say about what will happen at the convention. I don't think she really realized, she doesn't think that she's going to become president, but she wants to be able to say what she can do for the blacks, what she can do for the Indians, what she can do for the minority groups in America. She's not out to be president. She knows this is impossible.
She wants to make an opening for the women as well as for the black, and she, you know, she wants to bring us out and make a way for other people to travel along, and I think she really she has a heart in it. She's doing what she feels that she needs to do for the people of America.
She's white. Oh. Has there been attempts made of assassination?
No, I don't. There haven't been attempts. What we've gotten a lot is letters and calls that of attempts, not directly, but of course we expect this, particularly when you have a person like Congresswoman Chisholm. What she's saying and to whom she's saying it, and of course when you start reaching a cross section of the masses, you expect these types of letters and calls, and we do get them almost every day, both in New York and in Washington D.C. Yes.
Calls saying that they are going to kill her.
Yeah, calls indicating that if she continues to talk like she does, that that will occur, and of course the letters, they cut out pictures and they paste it and tell her how, what she really looks like, and if you continue to do that, you'll be strung from a tree like they do in some parts of this country and all. But again, that's expected.
It's expected. You don't expect any attempt.
Well, we don't know. There's a possibility that you may always find the person that may make an attempt, but we don't look to that. We take precaution. We take measures to try to avoid certain things, but you know, if you've seen other attempts here in this country, and if you're determined to do something, you do it. So we just can't say that we're 100% safeguarding her, because no one can safeguard that a person that much.
Are you armed? Do you have a gun?
Let's say we're protected, yes.
Are you a member of the Black Panthers?
Yes, I'm a member of the Georgia State Chapter of the Black Panther Party.
And you support Shirley Chisholm?
Well, I support anybody that supports the people. Because anyone that says that they're going to represent the people, not no racist, like one just for black, one just for white, but a supporter of all people, all oppressed and exploited people.
You believe in the process with election and everything, don't you?
Well, right at the time, I don't believe in it, but while it exists, then we have to support the candidate that's put in office to represent the people.
You were guarded by the Black Panthers in Atlanta. Do you need a guard?
Well, the Black Panthers understand in a very large sense what I'm trying to do. Some of them may have certain little hang-ups, but they know, they understand power in terms of what I'm trying to do better than some of the black male politicians in this country.
So you're welcome there.
I welcome everybody who wants to support me.
But
America is composed of all kinds of people.
Yeah. But you need the guard from them. Is it dangerous, this?
Well, let's say that, I am moving out in terms of running for the very highest office in this land. And because I am a very outspoken kind of person, people who care about me want to help to protect me, and I welcome the protection.
What do you believe America is composed of? Are we saying in America that only white males are the only ones that have all the brain power, all of the talent, all of the creativity? For 15 years of my life, I've been writing speeches for white males. For 15 years of my life, I have been the interpreter. Racism. That's why I say to the young of America, I gave up on my generation long ago. I say to you young people, I mean it. You're going to have to help me and others to change our country, to make it become the kind of country that it can be. All of us love America, but many of us do not measure America by her achievements.
We measure America by her potential for becoming what she can truly become, truly a haven for all kinds of peoples, regardless of race, creed, or color. That's what I am about as I go up and down the highways and the byways of this country. I have a vision, just like Martin Luther King had a dream. I have a vision. I have a vision that the powerless and the helpless in our country can come together, crossing sex lines, crossing color lines, and even crossing ideological lines. So don't underestimate me. When people say to you, don't waste your vote on Mrs. Chisholm, or she can't be president, all you say to people is this. Even if Mrs. Chisholm cannot be president of this country, Mrs. Chisholm will be able to go to the convention, the first national convention in this country, as an instrument of all kinds of people who've never had any input. And she will be bargaining for us at that convention in order to be able to put together a ticket that is reflective of the total American society. That's how you answer them.
Well, I think that this is one of the most significant cases concerning any black person in the past 30 or 40 years in the history of the United States. We feel it's so important because it goes to the very heart of the question as to whether or not a black woman has the right to defend herself when she's a victim of a white racist, sexist attack. And we feel Joanne Little acted in self-defense, and we feel that the way this question is answered will have tremendous repercussions throughout this country in regards to the life that black women are able to live. For centuries since black people were brought to this country, we had more or less been treated as nothing more than chattel slaves. And we feel now that white men have, in fact, taken liberties with black women and raped black women, and nothing has ever been done about it. White men have always been exonerated. But when black men have raped white women, they've gone to death row. Witness the situation in North Carolina with 80% of all people on death row being black. And so we feel that this case is tremendously important, and we feel that the attention that it's receiving is well deserved. And the only thing that we're hoping for now is that Joanne Little is exonerated, she's found to be innocent, and this will be a new day, I think, for black women in America.
She was like so many other hundreds and thousands of black people who get railroaded into prison and caught in that whole machine of judicial oppression because they're poor, because they aren't able to afford good lawyers, and because of the racism of the judge and the racism inherent in the judicial system.
One of the first major efforts we undertook was a campaign in North Carolina. Now, in North Carolina, there was a young woman by the name of Joanne Little who had been charged with the killing of a jail guard. I became very active in her case. And so we argued that that Joanne Little was being punished because she defended herself against rape. So here was a situation where a prison guard had forced himself upon her with an ice pick, had used an ice pick to force her to submit to rape, and when she then, after he had completed the sexual assault, grabbed the ice pick and stabbed him, she was the one charged with murder.
I don't know if it can change anything. At least it's bringing on an awareness, which I think is good, because I think more people would have to become aware of what the system is all about, how it works, who it works for, who it does not work for. Okay, you say justice for all is supposedly in these United States. But I think that the mere fact that you all are here, the case itself has brought about worldwide attention, which I think is good. I would like to say that it would change something, definitely would change something, the system itself. But being factual and realistic, I just don't know.
You think this is a good case to prove these cultural things?
I think so. I think that all these things are combined in one case. There have been individual cases involving different aspects, but not a whole combination such as this one. This involves all these at one time.
Well, how do you look upon the American system of justice generally when you compare it with this case?
Generally, the American system of justice is pretty much a failure to a large degree. This case may turn out, and we feel will turn out to be a victory for Joanne Little, but even if Joanne Little wins her case, that doesn't vindicate the American system of justice, because Joanne is a poor person. She doesn't have a lot of money, and the only way that she will have been able to have won this case will be that a lot of people have donated a lot of money and a lot of time. Poor people just can't amass defense like this, and this kind of case is happening across the country every day, all the time. And one case that gets in the limelight where things go right doesn't mean that the whole system works.
Joanne Little was never a person who became intensely political, but I think she recognized how important it was, not only for her own future, but for the women's movement and the black movement to organize around her case. We did an enormous campaign around her case, and as a result of the involvement of many different people, people who were involved in the black movement, people involved in the movement for the freedom of political prisoners, feminists who were beginning to take up the question of rape, got involved, and the outcome of her trial was a very positive one. She was found not guilty. It was important not only because it resulted in the acquittal of Joanne Little, but also because it demonstrated what we could do if we could only come together, if we could recognize that somehow differences did not mean that we could not work together, and that working on different issues didn't mean that we couldn't discover the connections and the intersections and the way in which they were cross-hatched and, you know, overlaying. So it was a powerful moment. And when we are striving to free individuals, myself included, it's not simply in order to get that one single person free. It's in order to make a point that that power can be generated by communities of people coming together. I think the story of my trial is an important story. The story of Joanne Little's trial is important, and the real import of these of the positive outcomes of these trials is that they demonstrated that people can collectively generate the kind of power that can be earth-shaking, that can change lives, that can change societies. People need to know that, particularly in the 21st century, it is important, even under a black president, to bring the kind of pressure, to force the kinds of issues that will allow us to imagine a future without war and without racism and without prisons.
This whole kind of falling in love with black things for a short period of time is essentially racist. It still is hypothesized on a great sense of separateness and a sense of treating black activities as a kind of a curiosity, either benign or threatening, one or the other. When it's threatening, you know, oh my God, they're going to riot or something. And when it's benign, let's let them paint or draw or sing or dance or whatever they want to do until we get tired of it, until, you know, we, the white community, get tired of it. And that whole structure is essentially racist.
All right, everybody, this is Queen Tahira. Thank you for listening tonight. We invite you to join us again tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with Brother Mike X and Open Mics Friday night. So until then, in the meantime, between times, this is Queen Tahira signing off for the evening. I love you. Good night.
So ready to learn, yeah. It's time to wake up, black people. Yeah. All my beautiful black people. Okay, so tell me, what the heck does it mean to be black? Is it rap music or trap shooting? Fathers choosing to leave and children losing. The family unit has depleted. We're defeated as a culture. Plus Big Brother always got us looking over our shoulders. As I get older, sweat gets colder. Unless you wear this war paint, please don't say racism's over. Cause when I walk in the store, try to buy my family food, they follow me, I call them out, and somehow I'm the one who's rude. My father served the nation, so me, I serve the nation. But the nation has replaced equality with toleration. So every day I wake up and tell myself I'm the man. And if your skin is lacking pigment, then you just can't understand. Brother Malcolm said, by any means, all I see is enemies. My brothers and sisters, we got to change our self-identities. If we ain't got us, then who else gonna have our back? We the only ones who really understand what's on this track, right? Time to wake up, black people. Yeah. All my beautiful black people. Yeah. It's time to wake up, black people. Yeah. All my beautiful black people. Okay, our history don't start with slavery, but tell me why that's new to me. Nobody ever told us growing up we came from kings and queens. They never taught from my perspective our story. Till the lion tells the tale, the hunter always gets the glory, huh? But we are much more than just a perception of an oppressive system designed to get us arrested, keep us apart, children neglected, see. We are more than just the mask that we put on to make some cash and bring it home, to spend it fast until it's gone. They don't want us to wake up. They tell us, get your cake up. All your dreams can be achieved with pale makeup. The miseducation of my people has took our vision. But if we look back, then we can find out what we've been missing. We've all fallen victim to the design of a system that redefines the community of the minds of our people. But this is equal. No change needed when our minds are feeble. This world is evil, but some knowledge can make you lethal. You know what I mean? It's time to wake up, black people. Yeah. All my beautiful black people. Yeah. It's time to wake up, black people. Yeah. All my beautiful black people. So who are you and who am I? We're done with all the lies, our eyes are open to the madness, so let's focus on the prize. If we don't put in work to reestablish family ties, then we doomed to walk the earth with no heritage to define. Be against our demise, I want our people to rise, I want us to all survive. But we have to free our minds, cause they got us in the bind. And they keep us wasting time, provoke us acting out of line, and dimming stars if meant to shine. Promoting ignorance is what's relevant. Suppression of our only leaders seems to be prevalent. Another Dr. King, I have a dream, will be heaven sent. But y'all, it's up to us to persevere with benevolence. Give each other strength to keep climbing, so when they bury us, we can use this solid investment as wings to carry us. Give each other strength to keep climbing, so when they bury us, we can use this solid investment as wings to carry us. Yeah. It's time to wake up, black people. Yeah. All my beautiful black people. Yeah. Time to wake up, black people. Yeah. All my beautiful black people.